Hey, man, is that the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast?
Yeah, man.
Well, turn it up.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast. We are here for our third installment on the Beverly Hills Cop theme. We just finished covering Beverly Hills Cop 1 versus Beverly Hills Cop 2, and we can't not talk about the Beverly Hills Cop 1 soundtrack.
I know, I love this soundtrack. I own this. This was a tape that I carried around with me for my Walkman. Did you have this one?
I don't know if I had this one. I know that I could listen to Axel F. any day I wanted to just by turning on the radio and That's waiting true. For 5 minutes.
That's true. The hits on this are amazing. Now, there's kind of a line where the top half is great, the bottom half is not so good, but this is going to be a fun one to talk about. It's such a moment in time. It's not an album I go back to and listen to a whole lot.
Yeah.
But the songs are great, and they transport me back to 1985.
They are absolutely a time capsule of the 85 sound, for sure.
This actually hit number one on the Billboard 200, June 22nd, 1985.
Nice.
So, big movie, big album. Of course, this is the time where MTV becomes this monster, and the movie studios realize that we can get a whole bunch more publicity if we put out a great song that has a great video.
Yeah.
They play every 10 minutes on MTV.
Yeah, they've got Footloose as a go-by form to go, okay, yeah, we need to do more with our soundtrack albums.
Well, and Flashdance, too, which was a Simpson-Bruckheimer.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the early model that they followed for Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
All right, so this won the Grammy for the best score soundtrack in 1986, which means that every artist who contributed a song to this album got a Grammy.
Nice.
Some are more deserving than others.
The also-rans, yes.
Yeah, that's right. Let's dive into it.
Yeah, let's get to these songs. They're too good not to.
Okay, so the first song on the album is a song called New Attitude by Patti LaBelle. All right, D, let's talk about Patti LaBelle for a second.
Okay, so Patti LaBelle is the singer on this one, written by Sharon Robinson, John Gillotin, and Bunny Hall, all of whom have written songs for multiple other people.
I'm sorry, did you say Benny Hill?
Bunny Hall.
Okay.
Bunny Hall, yes, that's close.
Hey, I make fun of that name, but uh-huh. She sang backup on Thriller. And for Billy Idol, I mean, she's a big time singer.
Oh, yeah. Heck yeah. These are all guys that they're like the Wrecking Crew. Like, it's like, we need some good songs written. We need some hits written. Let's go to these folks.
Sure.
All of these folks, right? Right. So who do they enlist to sing the song but Patti LaBelle? Hasn't had a hit in 7 years.
Right.
I don't know how that decision is made.
I don't either.
But, you know, I mean, do you know about Patti LaBelle's, like, history?
I know a little bit about her.
So she had come up with this group. This is, like, the worst name group I've ever heard. It was in the 60s and 70s. It was her and a couple of other doo-wop singers, and they called themselves the Bluebells.
Yeah.
And they had a few hits over the years, but ultimately reformed themselves into like a funk soul disco group,
right?
Called the LaBelles, as in Patti LaBelle, right?
Right, right.
And then everybody knows the song of the LaBelles called Lady Marmalade. But you may not know it by that name.
Voulez-vous coucher avec moi?
That's the first thing I learned in French.
I mean, too, right?
So they say, all right, let's get Patti LaBelle to sing us this new song on the album called New Attitude.
Well, so here's the thing. She has been called the godmother of soul, the high priestess of good vibrations, the queen of rock and soul. She's got this great voice, but I think that they were looking for a place to put her because they had signed her at MCA. She's a solo artist now. but she hasn't had any hits. And so they're like, look, we're going to attach her to this particular movie. We're going to write her some hits and we're going to bank on this.
Yeah.
So like you said, they got those songwriters and they come up with a couple of songs, including New Attitude. Now, New Attitude is the second single released December of 1984. It reaches number 17 on the Hot 100, May 11th, 1985. But here's the interesting thing. I wanted to tell you this. You mentioned Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells. They were the first African-American group to play the Metropolitan Opera House. They were the first African-American group to be on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine before they broke up in 1977. Now, this song, I don't know if you remember. Do you remember the Dr. Laura show?
Yeah.
She's like a call-in psychologist like the 90s.
Yeah.
This was like her theme song. Like, okay. I had a coworker in the 90s that I work with. She listened to Dr. Laura all the time.
Uh-huh.
And every day I'm hearing New Attitude by Patti LaBelle.
Uh-huh.
And the video for this song.
It's right out of the ZZ Top playbook, right? It's legs.
It is legs. It's totally legs.
Yeah.
She goes, like, shopping and gets a new wardrobe and comes out and she's looking great, feeling great.
She's got a new, she's getting hassled by the clerk and then she comes out looking all foxy and she's got a new attitude.
Oh, my gosh. So the success of New Attitude and another song we're going to talk about here in just a little bit called Stir It Up.
Yeah.
Leads her to a new song in 1986 where she has a duet with Michael McDonald.
Oh, yes.
Michael McDonald of the Doobie Brothers.
Uh-huh.
And he did some work with Toto. We talked about him on our Toto episode.
Yeah, that's true.
That song is called On Our Own. Was a number one hit.
I think that Bruckheimer knew about her because she had just started acting before this. Like just before they enlisted her to sing this song, she had started acting, played a part in A Soldier's Story.
That's right.
Yeah.
Before we dismiss Patti LaBelle,
uh-huh.
She's in the Grammy Hall of Fame. She's on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, the Apollo Hall of Fame, the Songwriters Hall of Fame. In 2005, she received the Legends Award and Rolling Stone ranked her as one of the 100 greatest singers of all time.
I think this song is great. I think the song has lasting power. I would put it in the top four or five songs on the album for sure. It's a great leadoff song.
It's a great pop song.
Yeah.
They don't play it in the movie at all.
Okay.
It's not in the movie one second.
So why is it on the soundtrack?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. All right. It is in Miss Congeniality Part 2, though.
All right.
Which is a favorite with my wife.
Yeah. Yeah. We're a Miss Congeniality 1 and 2 fan, family too.
Here's what I think. You want to hear what I think?
Yeah.
I think that their original intent was to use this for Jenny Summers.
Okay.
Like it's Jenny's song.
Okay. Gotcha.
She's feeling good. She's looking good. She's got a great job. She's busted out of the neighborhood.
Right. She's not in downtown Detroit anymore.
That's right.
She's on Beverly Hills Drive.
This doesn't fit with Axl. This is Jenny's song.
Yeah. All right. What's our next song?
Next song in the album is a song called Don't Get Stopped in Beverly Hills by Shalimar.
Okay. We've talked about Shalimar before.
Yeah, I mean, Shalimar had a big song on the Footloose soundtrack.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
Dancing in the Sheets.
Yeah.
That was a great song.
Yeah, I remember when we did that episode, you said that this was kind of a put-together band, and so I had to go look at that. You remember Soul Train?
I do remember Soul Train, yeah.
Remember the host of Soul Train? He was Don Cornelius. Well, he's one of the two guys that put this band together.
Okay.
Him and a booking agent named Dick Griffey picked out these folks really for their looks more than anything else, their looks and their ability to dance.
These guys can dance.
Yeah. And they were, I mean, the idea was we're going to be the trendsetters for the disco funk kind of sound and look. And so they'd dress them up in awesome clothes and have them sing this very hooky songs. And somehow they're still in early 1983 doing music.
Shalimar, we talked about how they're dangerously close to Milli Vanilli, right?
Yeah.
They were selected because they looked good and they could dance, not necessarily because they could sing.
Right. I mean, the group had Jody Watley in it, who...
She had some big hits in the late 80s. She had Don't You Want Me. She had Some Kind of Lover. She had Looking for a New Love.
They were lip syncing, but they were pretty much lip syncing to their own singing.
Right.
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 Unlike
Milli Vanilli.
Yes.
Hey, I'll tell you who is a big fan of Shalimar.
Okay.
Michael Jackson.
Wow.
In fact, he admired their dancing ability so much that he brought him in to help him coordinate the Bad video.
Right. Jeff Daniels, right?
Is that Jeff,
right? Jeff.
Good old Jeff.
Good old Jeff. That's a throwback to our very first episode, right? Like 4 years ago, everybody.
Oh, my gosh. Dancing in the Sheets was their biggest one. I got to think that they got Don't Get Stopped in Beverly Hills off of Footloose success. This is another song that was not in the film.
What the heck?
I don't know, man.
Okay.
But I'll tell you where it did appear.
Yeah?
In the TV show Misfits of Science.
Okay. Which, by the way, starred the same guy who played Predator and the helicopter pilot in Predator.
That is right. Good job. Nice pull there.
There you go. So this brings us to song number three. Do You Really Want My Love by Junior. Then I am way too fine. So Junior was British.
Okay.
He is one of the very first British R&B artists to be successful in the U.S. He had a big hit in 1982 called Mama Used to Say. Do you remember this song?
No.
Yeah. So that was actually a top 40 hit in the U.S. Was number 7 in the U.K.
Really?
I don't really remember it.
I don't know.
I feel like they were really trying to find a Michael Jackson sound on this one.
I can see that. The guy's got a high-pitched voice, kind of a funky dance thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, he did have at least a UK hit with Kim Wilde. Remember Kim Wilde?
Oh, sure.
Keep Me Hanging On and Kids in America.
Kids in America. I love that. We need to do that one for a Patreon episode.
I'd love to.
Oh, heck yeah. By the way, guys, if you haven't joined our Patreon family, please come and do so. You can do it for as little as $5 a month. Go to patreon.com/surelypodcast, and you can get access to all of our special episodes where we cover one-hit wonders or the Kids in America. We got to do that this year. Anyway, back to Junior.
So, look, this song is not good. This is not a great song.
This is on the bottom half.
This is below the Mendoza line, all right? So, this actually plays when Mikey and Axel are playing pool in Detroit. It's in the background. They're at the bar.
Right.
And he loses the money in the pool bet. And that's all we really need to say about that.
So you've got this Patti LaBelle song, and you've got this Shalimar song, and you don't put them in the movie.
Right.
And then when you got a space that you can put a song in, you put this turd in there.
Right.
All right, well, whatever.
Moving on.
Song number 4.
Song number 4. This song is called Emergency by Rocky Robbins. Tweet, tweet.
Okay, I can see the studio executives at this moment. We need another song. Can we get Prince? Prince had a good album last. No, we can't get Prince. We can get Rocky Robbins. I'm sorry. We can get who? I said Prince, and you said who? Rocky Robbins.
Yeah,
he sounds a lot like Prince.
He sounds like he's trying to be Prince. Yeah,
he sounds like he was Prince karaoke on a sad club somewhere in northeastern Oklahoma.
That's right, the Great Value Prince. In all actuality, though, he was from Minneapolis.
Huh?
So, good chance they knew each other, at least, you know, crossed over their paths.
Sure.
Like I said, every artist got a Grammy for this album.
I can't imagine. Yeah, can we get the guy from Paisley Park? I know a guy from Polka Dot Park.
All right. Now, listen, before we totally beat up on Rocky Robbins, I've got a great Rocky Robbins story. Okay?
Oh, wow. Okay.
I do. Okay.
I am impressed because I had to search high and low to find out who Rocky Robbins was at all.
Okay.
So, a great story. I'm excited to hear.
Well, a great tragedy.
Oh, no.
Okay. So he signed with A&M Records in 1979. Okay. So he's all fired up for his first record. Freaking yes, I got signed by a record company. I'm going to make my first record. So he sits down with the producers. They knock this out. They produce his first album. And on the way to deliver the record to the record company, the masters got erased. I don't know. I don't know the story of how. All I know is that when they got to the record company to turn it in, there is blank sound coming from the speakers. He had to go back and re-record everything and start over.
Well, did the re-recording sell well?
No, it did not.
Okay. I can imagine this Rocky Robbins guy sitting in a bar that looks like the club that they're in Weird Science, drinking whiskey, smoking a cigarette, and telling that same story for the 100,000th time to whoever will listen.
I was going to be as big as Prince till my masters got enraged.
Prince stole all my ideas.
This poor guy.
They just got erased. How'd they get erased? I don't know. They were in
when
the van.
When I didn't play, there was nothing there.
We had sound when we put them in the van. I took them out of the van, no sound. Oh my gosh, how crazy.
Well, but at least he gets a song on the Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack. He gets a Grammy for his effort.
I'm Grammy winner.
Right.
Damn it.
Now, this song is not in the film either.
That was actually a good choice. Good call on their part there. All right.
All right. Let's finally get to one of the big dogs on this album.
Okay.
This song is called Neutron Dance by the Pointer Sisters.
Okay, so you don't have to tell me where in the movie this song played.
No doubt.
I mean, if you don't automatically think of this scene as you hear this song, then you haven't seen the movie, because it is the perfect music for this scene, and it absolutely sets the stage for the rest of the movie.
So it's the opening scene when Axel is doing that cigarette deal, and the guy takes off and he's smashing cars through the Detroit streets. It's so great, right?
It is
it's like
fantastic.
The perfect song.
Perfect. You told me they didn't want this song.
They didn't like it.
Wasn't it Marty Brest again who was like, dude, this song is the song that has to be in this scene.
So here's the deal. Simpson and Bruckheimer were the guys that didn't like it.
Uh-huh.
So they asked Richard Perry, who was another songwriter, to create a better song. And he told them, guys, this is a 1 in a million song. It works perfectly with that opening scene.
The guy they asked to write a song to take this song's place said, you guys are idiots. Go with the song that
yes,
you have.
That's right.
That's freaking brilliant. Okay, so the song is by the Pointer Sisters, right?
Yes.
Okay, so normally in this circumstance, I'd give you a little history of the Pointer Sisters.
Yeah.
But let me just say that, okay, 1984, Automatic, Jump for My Love, He's So Shy in 80, Slow Hand in 81, I'm So Excited in 84, and then, of course, this one in 85. The band was, if you'll pardon me, on fire.
Nice.
See what I did there?
I
by the
did,
way,
yes.
I will save my history of the Pointer Sisters for when we do our top five of 1979 and we cover that song Fire.
Sunshine.
I think the great story on this one comes from a throwback to what we were talking about in our cover in the movie of Beverly Hills Cop, is that Allie Willis is involved in this one. And we have talked about her multiple times. Patreon episode again, we did September by Earth, Wind, and Fire. She's this incredible songwriter, and in all of the times that we've talked about her, I've never actually seen her picture, and you and I just watched a video on her, and yeah. I was like, number one, she's white? What? White girl?
Yep.
She grew up in Detroit, which right. is, we went to the Mumford High School. You know, Axel Foley wears
She went to Mumford High School, yeah.
Yeah, wears the Mumford t-shirt in Beverly Hills Cop. But she grew up outside of Motown, and so that was the kind of music that she listened to. Well, in our Patreon episode, we did a great job of covering that song, but we didn't know until just now that when she got the call from Maurice White to come help them write this song September, she was looking at food stamps to figure out what she needed most for the next week.
She's like, I need some bread. Here are some food stamps.
Goes from food stamps to recording writing one of the greatest songs of the 70s.
I guarantee September will be on our best of 79 at some point.
Yes. And then goes on and writes with Linda Ronstadt, just the amount of people, it just opens this door because it's such a huge success. And then the next thing that I think of when I look at her is not only is she white, but she looks like the lady you see at the 7-Eleven who's getting her eighth pack of cigarettes for the day and filling the coffee up with mostly sugar and has a dog with her that needs to be groomed and bathed. She looks not like a star at all.
No, not at all. And in fact, I just told you, we watched where she lived. She looks like she lives in Pee-wee's Playhouse. Let me just give you a list of just the highlights of her career, okay?
Yeah.
So we talked about it. September by Earth, Wind & Fire. Boogie Wonderland by Earth, Wind and Fire,
right?
You're the Best, the song from The Karate Kid.
Nice.
Right? Which we'll be covering here shortly.
Uh-huh.
What Have I Done to Deserve This by the Pet Shop Boys.
Right. Not only did she write songs for artists like this to be just big hits off of an album.
Right.
And not only did she write songs like Neutron Dance, where it's going to be in a movie, she gets a call in the early 90s to say, hey, we need you to help us write a song for this TV show. And she's like, okay, what's it about? And they tell her, and then she's like, this sounds awful. And they're like, yeah, it's not going to be a hit. Don't worry about it. Just write us something. We'll throw it in there. The show will be gone in no time. And she says, so I write the whitest song I've ever written in my life. You know what the song was?
I do. Wow.
So go back and check out our top five TV themes from 1994 to 1999, where we covered this song. But what the heck? She thought it was a throwaway song, and it becomes one of the biggest TV themes of all time.
So let's talk about the song for just a second. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was released in December of 1984. It goes on to hit number 6 on the Hot 100. Here's the thing about this song. I love the story. So she gets together. She's very disappointed and frustrated with her life, okay? So she had written a couple of gigantic hits, and she's still not doing very well. And so she's meeting with this other songwriter named Danny Cimbello. This is the brother of Michael Cimbello, the guy who did Maniac from Flashdance.
Oh, okay? Nice. Okay, yeah.
Right? And he's got all this energy, and he's excited to be there, and he wants to help her write this song. Well, they're trying to write this song for the movie Streets of Fire. Well, Streets of Fire is, we know it as this movie that came and went and really didn't do anything. It gave us a couple of songs like I Can Dream About You by Dan Hartman. They're writing the lyrics for this song. She's upset with her life. She's looking out the window while they're working on the song, and somebody is trying to steal her car. Right? And she owned this 1962 Corvair. She looks out the window, and she's like, somebody's trying to steal my brand new Chevrolet. And that's how you get that line.
Wow.
Now, the song itself is about a fear of nuclear holocaust and sort of partying in the wake of that.
1999.
Very similar to Prince's 1999. Like on the news, they had talked about this new neutron bomb that was more powerful than a regular atomic or a nuclear bomb.
Yeah.
And so that's what the neutron dance was.
Ah, it's like I'll Melt With You.
It's like I'll Melt With You. That's right.
Gosh, that's so good. That's so fantastic. Yeah, you said that her house looks like Pee-wee's Playhouse. She collects all of this weird memorabilia stuff. She literally holds up a box and she's like, this is Sammy Davis Jr.'s last box of marijuana.
So let's talk about the video for just a second.
Okay.
So you've got the Pointer Sisters and they're at a movie theater, and like on the screen behind the movie is Beverly Hills Cop. So it's this big advertisement for the Beverly Hills Cop movie, which is fun because we love the movie. We love the song. But you know who shows up in the video?
No.
Bronson Pinchot.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. Perfectly placed song in the movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great song. Great stories. I love it. I love it.
Yep. Okay, hit stop on your tape player. Kick it out, flip it over. Side two. And we start off with a banger. This song is called
The Heat Is On.
Yeah. Glenn Frey.
Here's what I loved about this, right? I'm listening to this song today, and I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if when I heard this song for the first time, I went, oh, okay, that's that guy from the Eagles. And then I started, you know, really thinking back. I'm like, I don't think I knew who the Eagles were in 1984.
Right.
I don't think I did. I think I started listening to the Eagles when I was like 13, and it was like starting to listen to classic rock stations, right? And so I really started to think about it, and I think I remember actually thinking to myself, the Eagles. Oh, hey, I know that guy. He's the guy that sang on the Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack.
And, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's the Boys of Summer guy. Wow, he's got an afro. All right.
That's right.
So I knew Don Henley and Glenn Frey from these songs, from the 80s songs.
Right, right.
And, I mean, we're about to cover the Miami Vice soundtrack, which, again, we're going to have a couple songs from Glenn Frey coming up there.
Two from Glenn Frey on that one, yeah.
But this one, oh, well, first, he born in Detroit, like yet another, Allie, Jerry,
Glenn,
all from Detroit, right? They didn't go to high school together, but Glenn goes to community college, has a band, you know, just kind of a general thing. But then he has a happy introduction to somebody that leads him to open some doors. And there's a weird coincidence with that.
Okay. So in 1967, he's bouncing around Detroit, playing for different bands, trying to make it. And he runs into this guy named Bob Seger.
Bob freaking Seger. Yeah.
Who helps him get a record deal and helps him write his first single. Coincidentally, when we talk about Shakedown.
Shakedown's on Beverly Hills Cop 2. Are we going to cover?
Maybe we should just cover that at the end of this album.
Okay, another bonus song.
We'll throw in Shakedown.
Bonus song of Shakedown at the end of this episode. We're bringing it.
So we'll come back to that.
Okay.
So Glenn Frey and Bob Seger have been friends since the 60s. So Bob Seger helps him put out his first single. You know, he has, well, you know, a little bit of success, whatever. So he decides he's going to move to California. So in 1969, he moves to California and he meets this guy named J.D. Souther. If you're an Eagles fan, you know who this guy is.
Yeah.
He helped him write a ton of their hits.
Yep.
Well, J.D. Souther was dating Linda Ronstadt at the time.
Uh-huh.
Linda Ronstadt needed a backing band to help her with her album. So she puts together this backing band, Glenn Frey, Randy Meisner, Bernie Leadon, and Don Henley. Of course, these guys then add Don Felder later, and they become the Eagles.
Yeah.
The freaking Eagles.
The freaking Eagles.
Take It Easy, Peaceful Easy Feeling, Already Gone, Lion Eyes, New Kid in Town, Hotel California. The list goes on and on, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're in a category with Beatles, Beach Boys, Pink Floyd. They are icons.
They are icons. They last from the early 70s, I think 71 until 1980. They break up.
Yep.
The big line, you know, when are you guys going to get back together? Glenn Frey and Don Henley, they always say when hell freezes over.
Yep.
Of course, in 94, they released an album called Hell Freezes Over when they got back together.
I saw him perform live in 94.
I saw him perform live in 94, too. Where'd you see him?
I saw him in Little Rock, Arkansas.
I saw him in Dallas. Okay.
They were, by the way, flawless. Like, there are those bands that are made in the studio. That's not these guys. These guys' music was perfect. It sounded just like the album, despite the fact that they were not playing any backing tracks. This was all them. Brilliant.
Yeah. So the song is written by Harold Faltermeyer and Keith Forsey.
Right. So we talked about Keith Forsey, of course, in relationship to Giorgio Moroder. Both he and Harold Faltermeyer worked heavily with Giorgio Moroder. Keith Forsey's also the guy who wrote Don't You Forget About Me.
Right. And of course, Harold Faltermeyer has Axel F, which we'll talk about here in a minute.
Yeah.
So Glenn Frey signs with MCA Records. They're having this big screening for Beverly Hills Cop, and his manager calls him and says, hey, listen, you got to get to the screening. This Eddie Murphy movie's coming out. It's going to be huge. You got to get a song on it. So Glenn Frey's like, okay. So he shows up and he's sitting there and he says, I look over one shoulder and there's Quincy Jones. I look over the other shoulder and there's Stevie Wonder. I look down in front of me and there's the Pointer Sisters. He's like, there's no way I'm getting a song on this album. It's not happening. So later on, Glenn Frey gets a call and it says, we're going to send you a song. We think it's going to be a hit. We think it's going to get on the Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack. We want you to sing it. So Glenn Frey's like, well, all right.
Just randomly, they happened to send him a song.
They said, we want you to sing a song.
For Jerry Bruckheimer said, I think my little brother played basketball against that kid. Let's send him a song.
That's right. And so they sent him this song. He says, yeah, okay, sounds good. I'll do it. They paid him $15,000 to do it. He called it a little Christmas money.
Uh-huh.
He comes in. He does the vocals on one day. He does the guitar solo on another day. And it goes on to become, listen to this, the highest charting solo Eagles song of all time.
Wow. Wow.
It reaches number 2 on the Hot 100.
And we're talking about a guy who had Smuggler's Blues and You Belong to the City. Oh, wow.
In fairness, You Belong to the City hits number two as well.
Uh-huh.
Boys of Summer only gets to number five.
Wow.
Blocked by Can't Fight This Feeling by REO Speedwagon.
Well, that's another great song.
It's a classic. I can't argue with it.
Yeah. Wow. And this song, again, you hear the song and you immediately play in the footage in your head, right?
This is the opening credits.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. It gives us our foothold in Detroit.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to the next song.
Next song on the album.
Gratitude by Danny Elfman.
That's right, everybody. He said Danny Elfman.
This is a pre-Batman, pre-Pee-wee.
Like the
pre-Tim Burton stuff.
Which is pre-Danny Elfman doing soundtracks at all.
This is pre-Dead Man's Party, which was Oingo Boingo.
I mean, obviously the song has a very Oingo Boingo sound to it.
Right.
And I guess I did actually technically misspeak. This was not his first. Now, we talked about Danny Elfman before. Remember when we did Batman versus Dark Knight, right?
Right, right.
And mentioned his work with Oingo Boingo and how weird they were. I don't know if you remember, but I talked about the movie The Forbidden Zone. Remember that?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Very weird, yeah. Weird movie.
It was softcore.
It was just, there was a lot of nudity, but I mean, it was just bizarre. I mean, Danny Elfman played Satan in addition to scoring the very weird movie. Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, not technically his first score, but this is, I mean, we're talking about, he is on the precipice of becoming the Danny Elfman. He's not there yet. Like, this is 84. 85 is when Oingo Boingo's biggest album comes out. It's also when he scores Pee-wee's Big Adventure for the first time. He goes on to score 100 or more different movies that are all iconic. And of course, The Simpsons.
Now listen, Danny Elfman is a prolific composer. This song's not any good though.
Yeah, where is it in the movie?
It's not in the movie.
Okay, so what is this, like four songs that we've had so far that are on the soundtrack that are not in the movie?
And then you have a prominent song we're going to talk about here in a minute that was not on the soundtrack, but in the movie. So,
okay.
Interesting selection process.
Yeah, that is weird. Okay.
All right, so let's get on to another song that really...
Yet another Grammy winner.
That's right, yeah. That's right.
This is my first Grammy for this song that was on the soundtrack, but not in the movie.
All right, let's talk about another song by Patti LaBelle. This song's called Stir It Up.
This is another fantastic song.
This is a great pop song.
This is top half. This is still, I still hear this on the radio from time to time. This is a good one.
This is what they play when Axl's rolling into Beverly Hills for the first time.
Yeah, he's where he's laughing at the guys in the Michael Jackson outfit that he actually wore when he did his stand-up routine.
That's right, that's right.
This one is also Allie Willis, who we talked about, and Danny Cimbello again.
Right.
Produced by Keith Forsey and Harold Faltermeyer, sung by Patti LaBelle. They had a little magic combination with these.
This is a great pop song.
Yeah.
It's played twice in the movie. It's actually played during the Beverly Hills scene and then the closing credits as well.
So she technically should have gotten three Grammys.
That's right. That's right. I do have a funny little fact for you on this. So it only hits number 41 on the Hot 100. So it's a moderate hit. It's not a big time hit.
Not quite top 40.
But it's a catchy pop song and it's good for this album. This song goes on to become the theme song for the TV sitcom Stir Crazy, based on the movie with Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor.
I did not know that that was a thing.
I did not either.
Okay.
I have no memory of that show at all.
All righty. Short-lived.
Yes.
Short-lived.
And then, of course, this song is, a new version of the song appears in Chicken Little. Good song.
Yeah, great song. I like
the
song.
It's a toe-tapper.
It's better than those references, but yes, it is a good song on its own, for sure.
Yep. All right, let's move on to the next song. This song is called Rock and Roll Me Again by The System.
Okay, so this is a song by a group called The System. The group was formed by vocalist guitarist Mick Murphy and keyboardist David Frank. Now, David Frank has been called by Yamaha Music as the founding father of electronic R&B.
Really?
Yes, and he's very white anyway.
Okay.
He decided to get into the keyboard side of things and the electronic side of things because when he was studying music at Berkeley, somebody brought in a copy of Wendy Carlos's album Switched on Bach.
Remember? Well, yeah, we talked about that in the Tron episode.
Exactly. Wendy Carlos had done the score for Tron. Before that, she had done this piece that, I mean, it blew the doors off of what you could do with electronic music back in the day, where she was performing basically like 8-bit Bach symphonies, right? And so at that point, he had been experimenting with getting his electric guitar sounds out of his Farfisa organ and decided, hey, I'm going to focus on electronic music, which Yamaha seemed to think he's a pretty big influencer here.
Okay, I've got a couple of nuggets for you on the system, okay?
Yeah.
So they worked on a song called It's Passion in early 83. So the person that they wanted to sing this song is a pre-Lucky Star, pre-borderline
Madonna,
right?
Okay, yeah.
Had creative differences with her, so she dropped out. And so David Frank ended up singing the song, and it became a moderate hit kind of in and around New York City. These guys worked on the song Susudio by Phil Collins.
Nice.
I Feel For You by Chaka Khan.
Chaka Khan.
But here's the thing. They had a one-hit wonder in 1987, a big one-hit wonder. Do you know what it is?
We're talking about The System here.
Yes.
No, I've got nothing.
I got to play this song for you. See if you recognize it.
Okay. So this is Don't Disturb This Groove?
Yes.
Okay.
You remember this one?
No. I remember Nighttime Lover. I don't remember Don't Disturb This Groove.
Don't Disturb This Groove hit number 4 on the Hot 100 in 1987.
Wow, okay.
Just listen to this group of songs that blocked it, okay? So I like this song. It's an 87 song. I Want to Dance with Somebody by Whitney Houston, number 3. Shakedown by Bob Seger at number 2.
That's ironic.
And number 1 is Alone by Heart.
Well, yes, those are going to be 3 songs that are very difficult to beat.
That's right.
Okay.
One more thing for you.
Yeah.
David Frank, the guy who plays keyboards on The System, wrote the song Genie in a Bottle that Christina Aguilera sings.
Oh, nice. Yeah, okay.
These guys aren't nobodies.
No. I told you, man. Grandfather of electronic R&B or something like
they
that.
They also wrote the title track to Coming to America.
Yeah, that's actually good. That's there a good go. One. Yeah.
All right, we done with that one?
Yeah, because the song's not good. Yeah, we can be done. We've talked up this band that nobody's heard of except for a brief period of time in 1987, and now we can move on because we're getting to the good stuff.
Yes, we finally get to the big one here.
Yes.
All right, D, we've come to the last song on the album and maybe the most famous song off this soundtrack.
This is what I came to this podcast to listen about. This is my favorite song by far on the album. I mean, we saved the best for last.
So let's talk about the banana theme. Otherwise known as Axel F.
So we talked about Harold Faltermeyer whenever we covered Top Gun, of course, right?
Right.
Because he did the Top Gun theme.
Absolutely.
You remember that story? You remember that, like, he was sitting at dinner?
He was at dinner with Bruckheimer and Simpson, and they were asking him about the Top Gun theme, and he was like, yeah, I think I've got it. And they're like, great, let's hear it. And he's like, well... And I said I had it. What I meant was I had a couple of ideas.
Right.
And he ran home real quick, like he left before dessert, threw it together real quick, and what we got was like the Maverick theme, you know?
He drove faster than they did, and in the 5 minutes before they got there, he already had it down. So I've got a reason for that, but I'm going to tell you, like, the full Harold Faltermeyer story.
Okay. Yeah.
So, number one, he's from Germany. But Harold is not really a German kind of name. Turns out that his parents made really good friends with an American GI when the Americans came in after World War II. They made this American the godfather of their son, and this American's name was Harold. And so that's why this German Faltermeyer has this very American Harold name.
This sounds very suspicious to me. Like, this GI got mom pregnant and...
No, godfather. He's the godfather.
Okay, all right.
I mean, it's like... Germany was in pretty bad shape after the war.
War American friend.
Yeah, no, he said that Harold, he met him several times, genuinely nice guy, very Southern American, you know, Southern Harry. Style. Yeah. Said he would dress up like an Indian, even though he was not Native American. But anyway, so his family was a group of not only musicians, like his dad was a piano player, mother was a singer, grandmother was a singer, violinist, such like that. They were also like college professors, like very smart and very musically educated. And then Harold Faltermeyer throws them a loop by dropping out of school before he's done. And they're like, okay, well, I guess you're going to be a garbage man. But then his dad realizes... Like, just to give you an idea, he not only was not a good enough musician to get into the music schools that they had then, right?
Yeah.
But he's dropped out of school, so he can't. He can't get into those music schools, okay. Right? I mean, the competition was steep. But what his father does is, like, he goes to the principal of this school, and he's like, he has to be able to study at this school. And they're like, he's quit school. He doesn't have the education he needs, and his musical talents aren't good enough. He's like, I don't care. I need to bring him in and show you what he can do. And so he brings him in, and Harold Faltermeyer has what's kind of like perfect pitch. And
well, wait a minute, because I read that he had something called absolute pitch.
Yeah, so basically they're the same thing. But what he can do is if you play a note, any note, he can go, that's C sharp, that's F sharp, that's B flat.
Right.
And he can also, with chords, you know, like that's an A7 augmented. He can hear it and he can tell you exactly what it is. Now, his technical skills were good, just not music level good. And so they're so impressed by his ability to do this that they say, okay, we will let you into the music school to study, but you have to sign something that says you're never going to try to teach and you're not going to go try to be in a symphony because that's not what we're qualifying you to do. We're just letting you study. It is really just to educate him, and that's it. And so he's like, all right, great. See you guys in the fall. And his dad's like, well, you're not just going to hang around and do nothing. And so he's like, we have some friends who own a recording studio. You're going to go be their gopher. And so just like Bon Jovi years later,
right.
He was the guy who would, hey kid, go get me a gin martini. And he would go and get that for the music guys. And he said, it was a 9-to-5 kind of recording studio. And he would be the one that was sweeping up whenever the lights, you know, are about to be turned off. So when everyone left, he would go in and he would explore all of the equipment, all of the recording studio stuff, and really became, you know, educated himself with his music equipment for months before he ever goes to music school and finishes his music school part of things and is an actual employee at this place now. And he's working for a producer, right? These are the big time producers. And he says, the problem that my producer had was alcohol. And he says, so one morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, we have an entire symphony orchestra in the studio ready to record. And my producer has gotten so drunk that he doesn't know where he is and he's not there. And so I'm just like, well, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do. And the guy who was running the show says, you know how to do this. You go do it.
Right.
He's like, I'm not allowed to do that. He goes, I don't care what you're allowed to do. Go do it. We have paid all of these musicians. We're not losing this money. Go do it. And so I can just imagine him. He's like going and setting this stuff up. And he's got other guys who work there who's like, dude, that's not where that microphone goes. Dude, that's not where those levels go on the recorder, whatever. And so when the producer finally sobers up and gets back, he's like, it's my fault. I will take full responsibility for however much he screwed this thing up, right?
Right.
Of course, it turns out to be one of the best recordings they've ever had.
Wow.
And so he gets an immediate promotion, and now he is the whiz kid on the block who's able to do stuff that none of the other producers could do. And so who should happen to be recording in a little place called Musicland Studios a couple miles down the road?
I'm going to guess Giorgio Moroder.
You nailed it.
Yes.
And so, of course, Giorgio Moroder, if you haven't heard our story on that, go check out the Top Gun episode. But he's heard about this WizKid. He's like, why aren't you working for me? Come do some stuff with me.
Fantastic.
And so, of course, then the relationship is born. And then Giorgio Moroder goes over to the U.S. He gets hit up to do these various soundtracks. He says, Harold, come over here, help me with these soundtracks. And so Harold goes over in 1979. He starts working with Donna Summer. He arranges this little song you might have heard of called
Hot Stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, now wait a minute, because this is where worlds collide. When you talk about Donna Summer,
yep,
and Giorgio Moroder,
yeah,
and Harold Faltermeyer, Keith Forsey's got to be in there somewhere.
Yeah, I'm sure that he's a part of the deal. I mean, we talked about him as well on a couple of different, multiple different episodes now and then, yeah, just a little bit ago. But I don't know what I didn't hear Harold talk about Keith, so I can't give you any more info on that. But anyway, so he comes over in 79. He starts helping out with these soundtracks and these other recordings, like with Donna Summer and stuff. Then 1980, he starts working with this group called Blondie, with this movie called American Gigolo.
You are kidding. This has to be Call Me.
You got it.
Well, wow.
Here's the bigger deal. It's not really Blondie that's playing all that stuff. Like, they came into the studio. Number one, Debbie Harry decided she wanted to do the music on this movie because she was attracted to Richard Gere. That was her motivation. But anyway, the band comes in and they're lackadaisical. They're disco rock band, right?
Right.
And so they'll just hang out, smoke some pot, maybe get around to playing a few bars and then smoke some more pot. You know, it's just meh.
Right.
And Giorgio Moroder is not into hanging out and spending a bunch of time in the studio. And so after a few days of this, he's just like, okay, we've got enough. Let's go. And they're like, whoa, wait, we haven't finished. And he's like, yeah, we've got it enough. We'll take care of the rest. And so they leave. And Harold Faltermeyer is really the one that plays almost everything on Call Me, which pissed the band off initially. I mean, he's got the keyboard solo in the middle, and the keyboardist is like, that's not me. And then Call Me ends up being the biggest hit for Blondie ever, right?
It's one of the biggest hits of 1980.
Yeah.
It's huge.
It's huge. So I can't imagine being in a band where your biggest hit was played by somebody else. But anyway, a little while after that, he calls Giorgio. He says, hey, I love working with you, but I just need some stuff to do on my own. Is that cool? And he says Giorgio is totally good with it. Helped him out. And then he gets a call from a guy named Jerry Bruckheimer, who is nobody at that point, right? He's just guy. He's just an executive at Paramount who's trying to put some movies together, right?
It's just a cowboy with cocaine and guns in the back of his car.
That's Don Simpson. Don Simpson,
okay,
right?
Okay. Yeah. No, sorry. Yeah.
Jerry's the level-headed one, right?
That's true. That's true.
But Jerry is got this movie called Thief of Hearts. Yeah. You heard of this?
Yeah, I have.
Okay, good. Because I had never heard of it. But he calls up Harold Faltermeyer. And Harold's like, why aren't you calling Giorgio? And Jerry's like, well, Giorgio's not really interested in doing this. He's like, okay, that was a dumb question for me to ask in the first place. All right, that's fine. And he goes, well, you need a song? And he's like, no, I was kind of hoping you would score it. He's like, oh, wow, dang, all right. I guess I'll do that. And so he writes the score to this movie that he says has a wonderful storyline, but basically the movie does crap. Nobody has heard of this thing, right?
Okay.
And then, even though the movie doesn't do as well, Jerry Bruckheimer likes it enough that when he hits 82 and 83, he's like, hey, I got this other movie. I'd like you to come try to write a score for it. He goes, oh yeah, what's it called? And he says, it's a movie called Beverly Hills Cop.
Yes.
And so Harold Faltermeyer is like, all right, sounds good, let's do it. And so he writes a song for him. He plays it for Jerry and Don and whoever the musical director is and Marty Brest. And they're like, nah. It's like, okay, all right. Writes a different song, brings it to him, and they're like, yeah, that's still not it either. I don't know.
Okay.
And so at this point, he's like, if I write a third song that they don't like, I'm fired. Like, I'm going to get fired from this movie, right? And he says, so he puts together this little simple melody and does a little, I mean, it's fun because there's a video out there of him as he's programming his Moog keyboard that he gets that perfect sound on, right? The perfect tone for the XLF sound. And he plays the tape for them after he's fully recorded it. And Jerry Bruckheimer is like, I don't know. And like the musical editor is like, I don't like it. I don't think it's going to be any good. And Don Simpson's like, I don't know. What do you think, Marty? And Marty's would smoke the cigarette.
Marty Brest. Okay.
Would smoke these cigarettes with the little tip on the end of them, you know?
Yeah.
He says he takes a drag of his cigarettes and he's like, play it for me one more time. And so he plays it for him one more time. Song gets over. And Marty Brest goes, I think that may be the perfect music cue for this movie. I love it. Let's use it. And Jerry Bruckheimer's like, okay, sounds good. Let's do it. And Don Simpson's like, yeah, sounds good to me. Let's do it. And the music editor's like, I still don't like it, but whatever you guys think.
Wow.
And so that is literally how it was born. And this is the important thing is he said that at that time with comedies, all of the music was like a symphony, like the old Looney Tunes stuff. Like you'd be a ding, 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 you know,
right.
It was that. So to do a techno sounding musical theme for a comedy movie starring the number one comedy actor in the world at that moment was unheard of. And fortunately, it was a risk that was well taken.
Wow. Great story. Great story.
There you go.
So for me, this song is like the theme song for the summer of 1985. Like,
oh gosh, yes.
My running around, you know, this is just the theme playing in the background while I'm playing wiffle ball with my buddies. Right?
I got the breakdancing cardboard back out for this song.
So this song actually made it to number 3 on the charts.
You know who kept it off?
I do. So here you go. You want to hear? I'm going to give you the top 4 from June 1st, 1985. Okay.
Yep.
So the 4th one is Don't You Forget About Me, which has Giorgio Moroder and Keith Forsey's fingerprints all over it.
Yes.
Which we talked about on our Patreon episode, Simple Minds from Breakfast Club.
Yep.
Right? Axel F. is at number 3.
Yes.
Which I always kind of hated that name, Axel F. That sounded like the kid who sat in the back of, you know, third grade class, you know, like I'm Jason C, you know, you're James G, you know.
Axel Foley.
I know it's Axel Foley, but I mean, call it Axel Foley. Yeah. Don't call it Axel F.
No, Axel F sounds cool. Yeah, I like it.
Number 2 that week is Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears.
That is, I mean, my children still love that song.
Oh, it's one of the great songs of the 1980s, which we will be going track by track through Songs from the Big Chair here in just a few weeks.
And ironically, we're going to be comparing Songs from the Big Chair to another album, which contains another song, which I think you're just about to tell me about.
I am. Yeah. So the number 1 song this week in 1985 is Everything She Wants by Wham! Off of Make It Big, which we're going to compare to Songs from the Big Chair.
Yep. I think when I heard Harold talk about it, he said it was Careless Whisper. So I'm sure that your information is more accurate. He was going by memory. What does he know? Well, he was like every week they would sell like 20,000 more copies than me, right? And the joke was, I mean, can now selling 20,000 copies is amazing because people don't buy the music anymore, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Great story.
Yeah. Incredible song.
One of the biggest songs in 1985.
Yeah.
Okay, D, let's talk about a bonus song.
Bonus song.
This song is not on the soundtrack.
But was in the movie.
Prominent in the movie.
Yeah.
The bonus song we're going to talk about is Nasty Girl by Vanity Six.
Well, we talked about this in our Beverly Hills Cop episodes. This is the first scene of the movie that they shot. It is the strip club scene.
Right.
And so you've got, Judge Reinhold talks about, you know, this kind of awkward, this is the first time we're shooting this movie with all these people, and here's this woman dancing naked above us for hours. And he says, but she told us that if I were dancing in a club, which I would be, this is the song I would be dancing to.
So the stripper came up with this. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Tonight, don't you wanna come with me? Do you think I'm a nasty girl? Well, this song came out in September of 82, well before the movie came out, right? And recorded by Vanity Six, written by?
The Purple One himself, Prince.
Prince, yes.
How about that?
And it's great because, ironically, what happens, not only does it become a very big song for Vanity, is it their only big song, really, for Vanity Six?
Yep.
But the reason he wrote it for her was because they were an item at the time, right?
They were.
Now, this was 82. Purple Rain comes out in 84. She was supposed to be the love interest in Purple Rain.
Without a doubt.
It was supposed to be her. And so whenever they have their falling out, what does he do? He just picks a girl that looks a lot like her.
I need a pretty girl that looks a lot like my ex-girlfriend. Apollonia, there you go.
Yeah, and then, of course, we talked about Vanity, the lead singer for Vanity Six, extensively in our Dr. Feelgood episode, because after she and Prince break up, she starts dating Nikki Six of...
Motley Crue,
yes. And the Heroin Diaries by Nikki Six, there's this moment where he sees like several dozen roses sent by Prince to her, and he's all mad, and he's going to kick that little dwarf's ass, and then he's like, Oh, no, it was her. She sent them to herself just to make me jealous. Vanity was a special human being.
Okay, so I kind of enjoy the rest of her story. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So she and Nikki Six are engaged, but he says he never really loved her because all they are just drug buddies and she's addicted to heroin, all this stuff. One day she's on a movie set with Flash Gordon himself, Sam J. Jones.
Wow. Okay.
And Sam says,
flashback to our Flash Gordon episode.
That's right. Which is a great episode. I love that episode.
Yeah.
He says to her, "Hey, you know, I just observing, would you like to go read the Bible with me at lunchtime?" And she says, "You know, nothing else in my life seems to be working." So she does.
Why not?
And she becomes like this on fire evangelist.
Yeah.
She drops the name Vanity. She goes back to Denise Matthews. And from that point on, her life has totally changed. She drops out of Hollywood and all she does is preach.
Yeah.
Now, she did end up dying of kidney failure because of so many years of drug abuse. So sadly, we lost her several years ago, but girl totally changed her life around and is not the nasty girl anymore.
Right. But this song is the perfect song for that scene.
But it is the perfect song.
It is the perfect song for that scene. And then I love the buildup and then the letdown at the end. The last lyrics of the song, and this is a woman covering this. The last lyrics of the song are, "Oh, is that it?
Is that it? Wake me when you're done. I guess you'll be the only one having fun.
Wake me up when you're done. I guess you'll be the only one having fun." Oh my gosh.
Okay, D, another bonus song. Let's do it. Shakedown from Beverly Hills Cop Part 2.
Another Detroit man brings it home.
Yeah, Mr. Bob Seger, who's buddies with Glenn Frey.
Yeah.
And they actually wanted Glenn Frey to sing this song.
Yeah.
And when you listen to it, I'm like, yeah, I mean, it kind of does sound like Glenn Frey.
Well, I could definitely hear him singing it, but you know who couldn't hear him singing it?
Glenn Frey.
He couldn't. He was like, "I don't like these lyrics."
He thought it was goofy.
Yeah, and he also was like, "I got laryngitis. I can't. Sorry, guys. Call Bob."
I don't get that, right? So, like, I know Glenn Frey. Glenn Frey, a little difficult to deal with sometimes. But here's the thing. Harold Faltermeyer and Keith Forsey write the song, "The Heat Is On." Glenn, you want to sing this? Yeah. Number 2 hit. "Hey, Glenn, we got another movie. You got another song. It's really good. You want to do it?" No.
"Let down your guard, honey. Just about the time to think it, it's all right. Break down, take down your first step."
It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yep.
This song goes on to hit number 1 August 1st, 1987. It's Bob Seger's only number 1 hit, and it was maybe the biggest song of 1987.
It was really, really big. I know that it was on MTV nonstop.
Of all the songs on Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2, this is the best song.
Disagree.
Okay.
But it is a great song.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
This was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Song and a Golden Globe for Best Original Song.
Didn't win.
Lost both times to the same song.
The time of my life.
Which we covered and is another fantastic song.
It is fantastic. Well, go check out our Dirty Dancing soundtrack album episode.
Yep, track by track. All right, I'm going to blow your skirt off with this. You ready for this?
Yeah, I got to just tell everybody what just happened. Like, we're here. We decided to throw this one on because it's such a great song and nothing else on the soundtrack is worth covering that we haven't already covered before.
Right.
And I'm looking, reading up on it, and Jason's like, "Don't look at the personnel." I'm like, "Don't?" And he's like, "Yeah, don't. I want to blow your panties off." Okay, I won't look. All right, so here it is. I'm waiting. Tell me what you got.
All right, Shakedown. Here's the personnel on the song Shakedown. Okay,
yes.
So you got Harold Faltermeyer playing the synclavier, whatever that is.
Sure.
Synthesizer, keys, drum machine, whatever. Yeah. Harold Faltermeyer is playing that.
Yeah.
Okay. The drums, percussion, that's Keith Forsey.
Okay.
Same guy who wrote "Don't You Forget About Me" and a million other songs.
Okay? Right, right.
Of course, the vocals are by Bob Seger, who's had a billion hits.
But very few of them number one.
That's right.
This is one of his only number ones. It may be the only number one.
It is his only number one.
Oh, my God.
You're talking about "Night Moves" and "Old Time Rock and Roll" and "Like a Rock," all these great songs.
Wow, okay.
Guitars on this song. Guitar. Can you guess?
Is Steve Lukather?
No.
No, I got nothing.
It's Dan Huff.
Oh, my gosh.
It's Dan Huff on guitars.
Oh, for those of you who are new to the show, Jason takes every opportunity to point out when Dan Huff is involved in any song because he is a huge fan of the song See You in My Dreams by Giant, helmed by Mr. Dan Huff.
Mr. Dan Huff.
I can't believe you snuck it in on me again. You rat. All right, everybody. Well, that does it for the Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack and a couple of bonus songs. Next week, come back. We are going to talk about another huge soundtrack from this era, 1985's Miami Vice soundtrack.
Yes. Fire up the Testarossa. There will be no socks allowed when we record that episode.
Got my loafers.